From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross and bringing you a couple of her interviews. First, Terry talks with poet Philip Levine. It's been years since Levine worked in the factories of Detroit, but the memories of sweat and fire have stayed with him. Now he writes poems based on that experience. His latest collection, What Work Is, just won the National Book Award. Also today, Terry talks with Joanne Folletta, conductor of the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic. Her orchestra performs newly discovered works from the past, as well as new music, all composed by women. And critic David Bianculli reviews Backtrack. It's a movie thriller Dennis Hopper made 2 years ago, but it's finally being shown on TV. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The latest round of Middle East peace talks moved through its second day today with few signs of progress. Israel was scheduled to hold bilateral talks with delegations from each of its Arab neighbors at the State Department in Washington. So far, only the delegations from Israel and Syria have met formally, and each side accused the other of refusing to budge. Negotiators from Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinians still haven't reached agreement on whether Israel should meet with a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation or hold separate meetings with each group. The Palestinians agreed to be part of a joint delegation before the peace talks began in Madrid, but now want to be dealt with separately. The Croatian president has protested to the United States about the economic sanctions imposed last week on all six Yugoslav republics. As Pierre Vickery reports, the Croatians want the U.S. to follow the European Community and only impose sanctions on those Yugoslav republics considered responsible for the war in Croatia.
In a personal letter to American President George Bush, Franjo Tudjman called for Croatia to be excluded from sanctions, which he said would seriously affect the republic's political and economic interests. He said the United States had already condemned the republics of Serbia and Montenegro for their invasion of Croatia, and it was unjust to impose the same sanctions on the aggressor as on the victim. Meanwhile, heavy fighting in several regions has further delayed a planned exchange of hundreds of prisoners of war near the central Croatian town of Karlovac. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The rape trial of William Kennedy Smith came to a quick end today after 9 months of preparation and legal maneuvering. The jury deliberated for less than 90 minutes before finding Smith not guilty. Doug Phillips reports.
Smith was acquitted of one count of sexual battery and one count of battery. He left the courthouse with his mother, Jean Kennedy Smith, at his side and thanked his family, friends, and defense attorney for helping him through the ordeal.
I especially want to thank Roy Black, with whom I've developed an enormous amount of respect and admiration, who has been, for me, a terrific source of judgment and wisdom and perseverance.
The jurors who acquitted Smith were escorted from court and did not immediately comment. It's clear, though, they found reasonable doubt in a woman's claim that Smith raped her last March 30th. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in West Palm Beach.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street after a session of mixed trading. Analysts said the caution was due in part to questions about whether the Federal Reserve will act again to lower interest rates anytime soon. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over a point and a half to finish the day at 2,865.38. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-3 in heavy trading of 206 million shares. This is NPR News. The inspectors who've been investigating Iraq's nuclear weapons programs provided the United Nations today with a list of European and American companies whose products were used in the effort. The list was prepared by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has asked UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar to determine whether it should be made public. At least 17 of the names have already been disclosed or confirmed by UN officials acting under condition of anonymity. The list includes the U.S. chemical manufacturer DuPont. None of the manufacturers has been accused of knowingly supplying the materials for Iraq's nuclear program. UN officials stressed that many of the products have other uses and could have been ordered by middlemen. President Bush said today that while his administration is keeping a close watch on events in the Soviet Union, he can't make any predictions on the political evolution there. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
Mr. Bush said while it is up to the Soviet republics and the center to sort out their problems, the United States' main concern is with democratic and market reforms, and that the U.S. will support reformers at all levels. In addition, he said the U.S. has received assurances about the safety of the Soviets' nuclear arsenal.
I see no reason to alarm the American people, but it's something that we're following extraordinarily closely, and we are in touch, and I feel that the thing to do now is just to go forward with the plan, the Secretary, and see where it comes out.
Secretary of State James Baker is scheduled to leave Saturday for high-level talks with Soviet and Republic officials in Moscow and Kiev. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Reform candidate Ron Kerry appeared to be headed for victory today in the Teamsters Union presidential election. The vote, ordered by the Justice Department, is the first in which rank-and-file union members had a direct voice in choosing the national president. As of this afternoon, Kerry had 54% of the votes counted. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. A few weeks ago, the National Book Awards were announced. This year's winning poet is Philip Levine for his collection called What Work Is. Terry Gross spoke with Levine earlier this year, and we bring you that interview today. The New York Times described Levine as a large, ironic Whitman of the industrial heartland, loyal to his roots in Detroit, determined to remember the exhausted and enraged worker, the unlucky immigrant, the man who gasps for breath and asks, "Am I going to make it?" As a young man, Philip Levine was a factory worker in Detroit. Now his work is writing poems and teaching at Fresno State College. But the sweat and fire of factory work continue to be the subject of some of his most compelling poetry. Terry asked him why work has been such an important theme in his poems.
I suppose because most of my poetry originates in memory. Coleridge said that really the only thing the imagination has to work on is remembered experience. And I find this is very true in my own case. Also, my working days went from age 14, that kind of work, heavy manual labor, from age 14 to about 29. And it seems to me that I was more sensitive to the world around me. I was a learner. I was somebody with his eyes open, constantly looking for teachers. And I think as a youngster growing up in these circumstances, I was just more open to sensation, more open it's an odd word, but almost an exotic world. It was the work of automobile assembly factories, and that it's a very exotic place, or it was when I was very young. There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam. Sometimes I remember going into a foundry once to get a job, and I was about 17. They wouldn't hire me. I was too young, and thinking, really, I'm in hell.
Yeah,
this is like hell. You know, it was so hot, and it was this liquid metal, and I was terrified. I was glad they wouldn't hire me.
I want you to read the title poem from your new collection, What Work Is. And is there a story you'd like us to hear about the poem before we hear the poem itself?
Yeah, there is. There's a curious story. I never worked at Ford Highland Park, which I mentioned in the poem, but I went there once for a job during a period in the early 50s in Detroit when there was a slight recession, so a lot of people got laid off, although Detroit was a booming town back then. And I waited in line, and it was raining, and it was a long wait. You know, the newspaper would advertise, you know, assemblers. That's the lowest job you can get. And they would put hours down, like 8 to 5, but you knew you had to be there early if you were going to get a job, and so you got there maybe 7:30. Well, they didn't open the employment office till say 9, so you stood there for an hour and a half before anything even opened, and there were 50 people ahead of you. But that was in a way to, you know, they wanted to test you. You know, how much crap could you take? Were you willing to wait in line that long? If you weren't, they didn't want you. And so as I waited, I grew angrier and angrier at myself for being this humble character. And finally, maybe about 10:30 or so, I got up to the head of the line. And there was a guy sitting down. I was standing. We each went to a different desk. We stood, they sat. And he said, "What kind of job would you like?" And I don't know where this impulse came from, but I said, "I want your job."
Oh, gee.
And he said, "Okay, take off." And that was it. But I was sort of happy that there was this thing in me that was still there that, you know, said, you know, "I don't want you and you don't want me." And so I suppose that I never forgot that moment of standing there all that time and then being, you know, a smart mouth.
Did you have the money to afford to mouth off like that and lose the pay for the day?
No. No, I didn't. I remember I went to Chevrolet Gear and Axle, which was an awful place, later that day, and got another got a job there, which was just as bad. You know, it was just as bad a place. I was married at the time. I had to make a living. I had responsibilities. So I really couldn't afford to be who I wanted to be. You know? Let me read the poem. What work is? We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac, so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
When did you start writing about your experiences in factories? Were you still in factories when you were writing poems?
I was unable to write any poetry about my working life while that was my working life. I tried a few times, and the poems were hysterical. I think they were just, you know, I couldn't control them. My anger was so overwhelming that I couldn't cope with it. Just as I couldn't write about my boyhood very effectively, until I was, 40. It was still too powerful for me. But I'm patient, so I hung in there, and that's probably my chief virtue as a writer, is my patience. So I waited, and I kept trying to write about factory work, but I kept throwing the poems away. And the first poem I ever published about working in a factory, I was, 31 or 2. But I don't like the poem anymore.
Can you give me a sense of what was going wrong in the Factory of Poems when you were still there? Is there anything?
Yes, okay. Yes, I can. The language was overblown. I wanted to use the word eternity, and I wanted to use a kind of Latin diction, to almost a Miltonic diction, and a great chorus, build up a great chorus of sound, and to dramatize the horror show of some of the places I'd worked. And I didn't have any. There was no tenderness in it for the people that I worked with. There was no, that was part of the reward that I got for those years, was the people I was meeting, even though you didn't talk to them that much because the places were often so loud. But you'd meet them afterwards, or you'd make friends with them and spend time with them. And they weren't getting in the poems at all. The poems were, my poor soul being hammered out of shape by General Motors. And they were a bit self-indulgent. Yeah.
A lot of times there's usually like two main reasons why a 14-year-old would work in a factory. One is because he or she or the family needs money. But the other is to be taught the meaning of work by well-meaning parents. So why did you start working in a factory so young?
Well, the jobs were there. It was World War II, and anybody in Detroit could get a job. And I wanted the money. I did it for the money, honey. I remember two young anarchists came to see me once when I was living in San Francisco, and they were enormously disappointed that I hadn't gone into factory work as a young guy to form cadres of the working class.
Yes.
I said to them, I'll tell you the truth, I went to make a living. And, I was discovering the beauty of women, for example. Actually, they were probably girls. I was more interested in women, though they weren't interested in me, naturally. I was 14. I was very short, too. And I thought in order to romance women, the way fellows were doing it in the films I was seeing, I had to have some money in my pocket. I had to have a suit to wear. I had to, if I possible, I could get a car somewhere. And I mean, it was hard to carry on a romance on the, on a Detroit bus or a streetcar. And so these were things that were driving me. I mean, just what drives, 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds all over America today, I suppose. And so I took these jobs and saved my money and got my suits and wasted my money.
Poet Philip Levine is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Philip Levine. His new collection of poems is called What Work Is. What was your final goodbye to factory work?
My final goodbye was, it came when my first wife left me, which is why I always love the word goodbye. And I didn't have to do this. Also, I wasn't in debt. And it just suddenly occurred to me, she's gone. I don't owe anybody anything. I'm going to quit. I'm going to live on my wits, or try. And so I started to try to live on my wits. And sure enough, I've done it.
So what did
not
that...
Not too well all the time, but,
When you decided to live on your wits, where did you go? What did you do for money?
Well, actually... I took a job with my brother. I don't want to describe it, because he'd get mad at me. And for a long summer, and I could live like a little church mouse. And then I went off to the University of Iowa to study poetry writing with Robert Lowell. And I thought there was a fellowship there for me. And when I got there, I was a year late. and the fellowship had been given to somebody else, even though I'd written them and said, hold it for me. And so I never registered. I just took courses without paying for them and kept saying, oh, that information will get to you soon. And I studied with Robert Lowell and then John Berryman. And John Berryman was a great teacher, just a great teacher. And I never needed another teacher after that. So I had a year of studying with two terrific poets and not living particularly well. Then I met my second wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her. She was just a lucky single woman. And we got married, and my wife worked for a while. And when our second child came, I started teaching then. And by this time, I'd published enough poetry to get a job teaching. And I'd finished a master's degree through the Mayo from Wayne University. So I lucked in there. I got this terrific woman. I mean, she's not just that she supported me. She's also a marvelous woman. I'm still married to her. Thank God. She hasn't abandoned me.
You've written a lot of poems that where your brother figures into the poem.
Yeah.
Do you see your brother as like the alternate version of your life or something? You know, like somebody who you could have been and you're not, or I mean, like what function do you see your brother as serving, almost as metaphor or something within your poems?
Yeah, you know, first thing, I'm an identical twin.
Ah.
And I didn't realize how significant this was in my poetry. I have a great many poems in which men have these encounters with each other, and a couple of poems in which they embrace very deeply, they hold each other. And I think that a lot of that, I remember a guy writing, a wonderful man named David Calstone, who's dead now, writing a review of one of my books and talking about these encounters and how powerful they were or how powerful he felt they were. And it was that review that opened my eyes to the fact that, of course, the roots of that are that the terrible wrenching away from my twin brother. I grew up half believing I was half a person. It's very curious to grow up as an identical twin. Not sure that I was the whole person. Maybe I was me and him both, or me. You know, it's very difficult to describe. But I don't think since I was five I've ever felt that anything as close as I'd felt up to that time. Maybe six or seven when we began to drift apart. And I remember when I first started writing poetry, it was enormously, I was about, oh, I don't know. Well, actually, I didn't show my brother the first poems I wrote. I didn't show him poems until I was about 17 or so. And he loved them. He just loved them. And he would take, he's a bigger guy than I, and he's more aggressive physically and in every other way. And he would take these poems and show them to people and say, what do you think? Isn't this great? That's what he would say. Isn't this great? And, of course, they'd say, yeah, because he was kind of an intimidating guy. My brother's a great poet. And in some ways, it was the high point of my writing career. I mean, I had one reader, and he was absolutely mad for what I was doing. Now I have many more readers, but I don't know if any of them, you know, are so totally, totally taken with what I write. 'Cause I was really writing totally for two people, myself and my brother. Since then, I've discovered others but it was quite amazing.
You said that you were wrenched away from your twin brother. When were you wrenched away?
I was afraid you'd ask that. I just felt at a certain point in my life that when I was quite young, that I had to be myself. I began to make discoveries about him, that he wasn't me. There were ways in which he reacted to experiences. I could see that. It was they just weren't my reactions. And so a time came when I said, I can't go on with this. I have to find out my own identity and live it. And so I suppose the wrenching was a something I imposed upon myself. My guess is he probably felt something similar. I do think there were times when our inmost thoughts were communicated to each other without our speaking. We were that close.
How close are you now?
I'd rather not talk about that.
That's fine, okay. Does he still read your poems?
I don't know. I would hope so.
I want to get back to something you said early in the interview.
Sure.
You said that, then this is when you were, you know, waiting online for factory jobs and knowing that you might get turned down. You said you couldn't afford to be who you wanted to be. And I think within that sentence is a pretty interesting class analysis about identity. You know what I mean? That it takes a certain amount of money in a way to live, not only to live the life you want, but to be who you want to be.
That's right. That's right. I mean, for example, I was politically very conscious. I was aware of exploitation. I remember my brother and I at about age 10 swearing we would never exploit other people. We would never live off the labor of other people, you know, in a way in which they were abused and we were given an advantage on their hard work. And I remember when I worked at for a General Motors factory once, you had to take these IQ tests before you started working. And they said, you know, we'd like to put you into our management program. You've done very well on this IQ test. I lied and said I'd never gone to college or they'd never hire you. And they said, gee, these scores are wonderful. And I said, no. And they said, we would send you to Flint, Michigan. You go to a school there. You know, we have a slavery school there. You know, you'll be taught really how to torture people effectively and subtly. And we'll pay it twice as much. And when you're done, we'll give you a suit and a tie. Wouldn't you like to do that? I said, no, I just like to be a slave myself. I mean, I didn't like being a slave, but I had taken an oath that I wasn't going to exploit people. And my brother was watching me. I couldn't break it. He's a very stubborn guy. And so it was a determination we made. It would be nice to be able to afford it. Of course, then what do you have to do? You have to change the world so that lots of people can take that oath and live it, right? And how did I choose to change the world so that was more possible? I wrote poetry. And I actually thought, and this will strike you, Terry, as idiotic.
I actually thought that
writing poetry would be a means of changing the world. Because what I was reading was changing me so radically. Nothing in my life had as much power over me as what I read, both poetry and fiction. And when I began, too, I wanted to be a novelist as well as a poet. Then, of course, when I published my first book in an edition of 220, I said to myself, gee whiz, this is a big country for 220 books.
But you feel that in some ways poetry is obsolete for a lot of people because they have movies and TV and songs to tell their stories.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. By this time, I didn't care because by this time, I had fallen in love with the poem and I loved writing it and I didn't care. I mean, it was what I had to do. And whether it changes people or whether it doesn't, it's what I have to do.
Philip Levine, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice. It's a pleasure.
Poet Philip Levine speaking with Terry Gross in an interview recorded earlier this year. A few weeks ago, Levine was awarded the 1991 National Book Award for Poetry for his collection called What Work Is. A new edition of his 1984 collection, Selected Poems, has also just been published. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Even as a child, Joan Folletta wanted to conduct a symphony orchestra. But as she got older, she learned that women don't conduct. Even in college, they tried to keep Folletta off the podium. Coming up, Folletta tells us about conducting the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic, an orchestra dedicated to performing old and new works by women. Nearly 3 years ago, actor and director Dennis Hopper made a movie called Backtrack. It was a thriller starring Hopper as a hired killer who becomes obsessed with his target, Jodie Foster. That film never got released in theaters, but this weekend it's being shown on TV. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In West Palm Beach, Florida, a jury in the trial of William Kennedy Smith was out less than 2 hours before it returned a not guilty verdict on charges of rape. After the verdict, Circuit Court Judge Mary Lupo thanked the jury for its time and said, "You have done justice regardless of your verdict." Smith is seen and heard on CNN, also thanked the jury and his family.
They say that gratitude is the memory of the heart. And I have enough memories in my heart to last a lifetime. I want to say thank you, most of all to my mother. I don't think it's possible for a child ever to repay the debt they owe their parent. I only hope that I can be as good a parent to my children as my mother has been to me.
Supporters of the accuser condemned the verdict, though, and said now, because of the trial, a lot of rape victims will not come forward. In eastern Tennessee, officials are looking for an escaped jail inmate who shot to death a deputy sheriff with a gun that he stole from another deputy. More than 100 law enforcement officers have set up roadblocks in their search for Charles Williams Saylor near Mountain City, Tennessee. The 24-year-old inmate escaped from the Johnson County Jail this afternoon, and officials say that he is armed with 2 semi-automatic guns taken from 2 deputies. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today in its first sexual harassment case since Justice Clarence Thomas joined the court. At issue in the case is whether a student can sue a school system for monetary damages over charges that she was sexually harassed and coerced into having sexual intercourse with a teacher. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Because the bitter Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing centered on allegations that Thomas had sexually harassed his one-time employee, Anita Hill, all eyes were on the court's newest justice in today's case. Would he disqualify himself to avoid any appearance of prejudice? Legal ethics experts said that, under the canons of judicial ethics, he had no obligation to do so. And Thomas did not recuse himself. He was on the bench this morning to hear the case of Christine Franklin versus the Gwinnett County School District. But while all the other members of the court asked questions during the lively hour of argument, Thomas remained silent, asking no questions. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Officials in Tokyo say that Japan's trade surplus climbed over $6.5 billion last month for an increase of nearly 192%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 2 points to close at 2,865.38. This is NPR News. Secretary of State James Baker flies to Moscow this weekend for meetings with top Soviet officials. In the meantime, President Bush says that events in the Soviet Union are being watched very closely, in particular, just who is in control of nuclear weapons. Yesterday, CIA Director Robert Gates told Congress that the Soviet people are facing a possible collapse of central authority and the possibility of large-scale civil disorder. With about 15% of the vote counted in this week's Teamsters election, underdog candidate Ron Kerry holds a strong lead over 2 rivals for the union's presidency. It's the first time rank-and-file Teamsters have had a direct say in choosing their national officers. NPR's David Mopus reports.
In the first official tally, the presumed frontrunner, national Teamster leader R.V. Durham of North Carolina, trails upstart challenger Ron Carey of New York by 18%, with a third candidate far behind. Carey, the least known of the candidates at the start of the race, campaigned hard against the union establishment, promising continued democratic reforms and tougher bargaining with employers. He has the backing of a longtime dissident movement within the union. Final results in the government-supervised election are not expected till week's end, and it's unclear if the current trend will hold. Carey's campaign manager says, "Our wings are sprouting, but not yet soaring." I'm David Malpas.
Democrats have gone to court in an effort to change federal rules on campaign financing matchings. Democrats charge that the White House will be able to use up the available matching funds to make sure that Democratic presidential candidates will not get as much for early primary battles next year. The suit alleges that a shortfall in campaign matching funds will occur early next year, and more than 40% of delegates to the Democratic National Convention are chosen. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Bay Area Women's Philharmonic is an orchestra with a mission: to perform neglected historical works by women and to perform new works by women as well. The orchestra is entering its second decade. Terry Gross spoke with its conductor, Joanne Folletta. She's also the music director of the Long Beach Symphony Orchestra and the Virginia Symphony. Before joining the Women's Philharmonic, she had won the Stokowski, Toscanini, and Bruno Walter awards. The Women's Philharmonic has one recording featuring Baroque music of 18th century women composers. This composition, Symphonia in C, was written by Marianne Martinez in 1770.
When you're looking at a piece from the early 18th century written by a woman, you're looking at a piece composed by a woman who has not had the benefit very often of significant training, compositional training. You're looking at a woman who's relying on essentially raw talent and that alone to create this piece. So as a conductor, you have to be even more creative about helping it work to the best of its abilities. And that's a great challenge. It's a great challenge to come up with a piece that's never been played, that you can't hear on a recording, that has errors in it, that perhaps, you know, needs work in certain areas, and to get that to the point where it can be a very successful performance.
You became the conductor of the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic in 1985. You'd already won several prestigious conducting awards. Did you ever have any reservations about accepting the Women's Philharmonic invitation? Did you think perhaps that conducting a women's orchestra would in its own way narrow your career because you'd be perceived as like an advocate of women's music rather than a conductor who could do anything?
Well, you know, Terry, I did have some reservations, I have to be honest, because first of all, I didn't know anything about music written by women. My training as a conductor had been very traditional. I mean, and I learned the established standard repertoire of the orchestral world. And when I was first approached by the Women's Philharmonic, I had a feeling that, well, what is this music? And could it really be any good? And it wasn't until I went out and took a look at scores and worked with the orchestra that I began to realize that this was a wealth of repertoire that was really good and very interesting to me. And I guess I didn't worry really about being typecast as a conductor, although I know that conductors do get typecast. But I think I've been lucky in that I've been able to work on a great deal of standard repertoire as well. Although now when I do guest conduct, very often people will specifically ask me, please do a piece by a woman or please bring one of the pieces from the Women's Philharmonic for our program.
You've said that when you were studying conducting with George Mester at Juilliard, that he showed you ways in which you were undermining your authority as a conductor. What did he point out to you that you were doing?
Working with George was very, very valuable for me because he had never trained a woman as a conductor because there was just so few of us. He became very aware of the fact that women are trained by society to be nurturing and not always to be demanding or expecting of excellence. So he pointed out to me ways in which I was using language, perhaps, in a manner that undermined my authority, or perhaps using an apologetic approach to the orchestra that again undermined my authority. He helped me see that I had to get rid of some of the trappings of what I had learned as a young girl growing up and learned to be more demanding, again, in a way that was comfortable for me.
Can you give me some examples of things that you stopped doing?
Yeah, well, he pointed out that very often I and women in general would use words like just and only in an apologetic way. For instance, I would say to the orchestra, well, let's just try it one more time. And he pointed out that none of my male colleagues would use well or just in that sentence. They would say, we'll do it again. And that kind of difference in language made me realize that perhaps I was uncomfortable with demanding. And yet, I had to learn to do that because that's what a conductor does.
In the orchestras that you've conducted outside of the Women's Philharmonic, do you feel that you were called on to prove yourself in ways that a man might not have been asked to?
Well, in almost all the orchestras that I've worked with, I have been the first and in many times the only woman that the orchestra has experienced on the podium. So yes, I think there has been a proving period. Orchestras in general tend to be suspicious of conductors, and you know they want to be sure that they're working with someone who's utilizing their time well, you know. So the fact that it was a woman engendered a kind of excitement, I'm sure, and also kind of feeling, well, let's see what she can do. So I felt that I had to be more well-prepared probably than any of my male colleagues, and I had to work in a way that that was extremely professional. And what I found is that musicians respond in an extremely professional way, and I haven't encountered the overt kind of prejudice that perhaps we feared.
You say that musicians are often suspicious of guest conductors. Is it like a substitute teacher, you know, where we don't behave as well?
It is. And, you know, in conductors in general, you have to realize that to be a musician in an orchestra is not a natural progression, because when one is studying at Juilliard or at Curtis, you're not studying to play second violin last stand. You're studying to be another Isaac Perlman. You're studying to be a soloist. And then life, you know, works itself out, and there you are in an orchestra playing in the second violin section. But you still have those same desires. You still have that same kind of spirit of individuality. And then here comes the conductor, who is essentially going to be telling 90 or 100 people how to play it and what to do and how to phrase. So you can see that the role of a conductor is potentially a very difficult one, because you have to convince that group of great musicians, all of whom have their own ideas about how to do it your way and how to feel good about that. So I think orchestras in general tend to judge conductors rather harshly because of that, because they have such strong musical integrity of their own.
What do you wear when you're conducting for a performance?
Well, you know, the issue of what a woman wears on the podium is something that still has not been resolved, and I have to answer that by saying that in different parts of the country, I wear different clothing. My concern is always that whatever I'm wearing be non-obtrusive and enable people to listen rather than watch. And that's the reason, of course, why orchestra musicians wear black, because it is an oral experience, and we don't want to be distracting by what we wear. In San Francisco, for instance, I very often wear tails, and that for a conductor is the most comfortable, least limiting, least constraining costume or outfit, and it enables me to be very professional and to work well.
This is tails with pants or with a skirt?
Tails with pants.
Oh.
In other parts of the country, that hasn't been as well accepted, and so when I'm conducting in, let's say, Texas or Virginia or Georgia, I will wear probably a black skirt and white blouse and jacket, or a black dress with a jacket. Again, it's my aim is to make people feel comfortable so that they get beyond the idea that there's a woman on the podium and into what the music sounds like.
So if you wear tales in some parts of the country, do they think you're cross-dressing or something?
People have said that. It's so strange to me. People have mentioned that, you know, and I've always said, you know, this is a professional outfit for a musician, and it doesn't mean anything about, you know, men or women. It just means that this enables me to utilize the motions that a conductor needs to use and to do it in a non-distracting way. But again, I think it still is an issue that hasn't been resolved for women on the podium, and maybe won't be for a number of years until we have enough women, perhaps, that a standard dress or outfit evolves.
My guest is Joanne Folletta, conductor of the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Conductor Joanne Folletta is my guest. When you started studying conducting, were you ever discouraged from pursuing it because you were a woman?
Well, yeah, because, you know, I made up my mind to be a conductor when I was 13, and I didn't know at that time that women didn't conduct. It just didn't occur to me. I guess I was very naive. My parents were not musicians, professional musicians, so they didn't know. And the first I heard of that was when I was 18, and I entered the Manus College of Music in New York as a classical guitarist, and I told them that I wanted to study conducting. And they said, well, you know, women don't do that. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, it's just never been done. I mean, it's just not something that would be accepted. So it took me an entire year to convince them to give me a chance to study. And that was the beginning for me, because then I was able to study formally. I was able to conduct my school orchestra. I was able to make progress and eventually go on to Juilliard, where I got my master's and my doctorate. And again, I think there was some reservation about, can a woman really be a successful symphonic conductor? But I'm really very grateful to them for taking that chance.
What were the stereotypes you were up against, the stereotypes of why a woman can't conduct?
Well, I think people still had in mind the image of someone like a Toscanini as a conductor, someone who, well, first of all, was European. I mean, and Americans always struggle with that. Secondly, was a total autocrat, someone who could, you know, hire and fire people at will, who would throw batons at members of the orchestra, who would have temper tantrums. The idea of a woman behaving in that way was not one in which people felt comfortable. And I still think that women on the podium have to be very careful about how they use anger to inspire people. I'm not sure that it works as well for women at this time in our society as it does for men.
Do you think that you're more careful about how you use anger because you're a woman?
Definitely. Definitely.
How?
Well, I've played in orchestras, and I must tell you that I've, you know, as a young person playing cello and looking up at the conductor and the conductor getting angry at us, I found was a very powerful motivator. You know, he was angry and we had to do better. We had to please him. I found watching women that anger usually takes away from their authority. And I can't say exactly why that is. But there is still a strong discomfort level in our country and all over the world with seeing a woman expressing anger. So I found that for myself, I can use other emotions more effectively. I can use disappointment. I can use high expectation level. I can use, being demanding in the sense of wanting the very best for the sake of the music more effectively than if I got angry and indicated that in a way that, you know, a man might still be able to do with some good effect. I don't think it's fair, but that's the way it is.
Since you're not playing familiar works, whether the works are old or new, these are basically newly discovered, that means that the women in your orchestra have to learn new things all the time, perhaps more so than your regular orchestra would need to, because there is a certain amount of familiar music in the repertoire that's played at your typical concert. But not for
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely. And I think this is what makes the orchestra so remarkable, because we are asking the members of the Women's Philharmonic to play new pieces every concert. Every piece is new. We're asking them very often to read from manuscript, that is, not printed music, but the composer's own handwriting. We've asked them, and let's say in the case of Lily Boulanger, who's writing during a very serious illness, I mean, at the end of her young life, to read from her handwriting, which is extraordinarily difficult, yet these musicians are willing to do that.
The Bay Area Women's Philharmonic has one album of 18th century Baroque composers. And I'd like to end our interview by playing an excerpt of a piece that you are the featured lute soloist on. And this is a piece by the composer Camilla De Rossi. It was composed in 1709. Would you tell us a little bit about this and about why you wanted to perform it?
Well, this is a wonderful example of a composer who's totally unknown, who is a very, very gifted composer. This is a instrumental selection from The Sacrifice of Abraham, you know, written, of course, on the Bible story of Abraham and Isaac. And I was particularly charmed by it because the lute in the piece represents the angel who first appears to Abraham and tells him that he must sacrifice his son, and then, of course, at the very last moment, reappears and says that since Abraham has shown so much faith, he doesn't have to do it now. And the work, I think, is a wonderful piece, and I'm very, very proud that we found this work. It had never been recorded before, and I'm pleased to have been the soloist on it.
Well, before we hear this piece, let me say thank you very much for talking with us. And good
luck
with your new season.
Thank you very much.
Joanne Folletta will conduct the Women's Philharmonic at the Kennedy Center in Washington on January 12th as part of the National Organization for Women's 25th Anniversary Celebration. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On today's program, we'll be hearing the news from Holland, where European community leaders have been meeting, and where this week they agreed to new terms of a single market for Europe by the end of this decade. We'll also be hearing about the economic woes in Moscow and why Russian President Boris Yeltsin wants the seven industrialized democracies to give him $5 billion. To stabilize the ruble. Also, we'll be hearing today about Peruvian President Fujimori's difficulties with the rebel movement, The Shining Path, and a talk with the leader of the Clubfoot Orchestra about his composition, a new film score to accompany the old silent picture, Metropolis, coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
This weekend, the Showtime cable network premieres a movie called Backtrack, starring and directed by Dennis Hopper, co-starring Jodie Foster, and featuring a supporting cast that includes John Turturro, Dean Stockwell, and Joe Pesci. TV critic David Bianculli says it's a movie that's interesting in more ways than one.
This isn't the first time a cable network has pulled this trick, but it's definitely the most noteworthy. Even though Backtrack is billed as a Showtime original movie, it's not technically a made-for-TV movie at all. It's a film that was made in 1989 but never got theatrical distribution. It sat on some shelf for almost 3 years until Showtime bought it on the basis of its cast. And what this means, really, is that Backtrack is actually a sort of lost episode, or missing link, in the career resumes of several established or up-and-coming stars. You get to see Dennis Hopper and Dean Stockwell acting in the same movie again, 3 years after Blue Velvet. You get to watch Hopper as director, in a project that came after Colors but before The Hotspot and is better directed than either one of those. There's Joe Pesci in a small but memorable part, playing a tough-talking gangster in a role that predated both Goodfellas and Home Alone. There's John Turturro playing a gangster in a role that came before his featured part in Miller's Crossing. There are Fred Ward and Vincent Price in tiny supporting roles, and there's even a one-scene cameo appearance by Bob Dylan. Most of all, though, there's Jodie Foster, in a starring role that came before The Accused and Silence of the Lambs. In Backtrack, she plays a conceptual artist named Anne Benton, who accidentally witnesses a mob hit. She files a police report, but panics and runs when she sees one of the murderers in the precinct house, as a high-ranking cop. The police, both good and bad, go after her. So does a hitman named Milo, who's played by Hopper. Milo learns all about her, becomes obsessed by her, and tracks her down. He sneaks into her bedroom one night, handcuffs her, ties a scarf around her neck, and makes her an offer.
Either I finish you now, or I let you live. And if I let you live, your life is mine. And you belong to me. And if you go against me in any way, I'll finish you. The choice is yours. Make it.
It's a really interesting performance by Hopper. And Foster shows her own toughness and sex appeal by deciding to play along while waiting to make her move, and gets in some shots of her own during the process. In this scene, Hopper's Milo is so infatuated with her that he brings along some of her own sexy clothes for her to wear, which she puts on, intentionally taunting him while he watches.
You want me to be a hooker, Milo? A little playboy centerfold, huh? Vulgar little tart? Is that what you want?
Oh, that would be nice. Slow.
Let me tell you a little something about men, Milo. They have no imagination. You have no imagination.
Oh, I do have imagination. I can think of lots of things. In fact, I'm thinking of a few of them right now.
Their scenes together are the best part of Backtrack, but there's also the delightfully sarcastic character played by Pesci, who never met an obscenity he didn't like. Here, his character erupts when one of his underlings, played by Turturro, calls him boss.
Boss, I was thinking that...
Boss? Now I'm a... This f***ing joint is bugged, I told you a million times. You gotta make me a boss. How'd you like to be the f***ing boss? Boss of what? Make me a f***ing kingpin.
Yes, the movie falls apart near the end. And yes, the relationship between Anne and Milo advances much too quickly. But it's not a bad film. Its art world background is well taken advantage of, and it's fun seeing all these familiar faces in a lost film. You also have to give Jodie Foster a great deal of credit, or something, for making a film in which her character falls in love with a pistol-packing guy who's obsessed with her and willing to kill for her.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Cary Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Marty Moss Cowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, Life on the Road, we talk with Bruce Thomas. For a decade, he was the bass player in Elvis Costello's band, The Attractions. Also, from Saturday Night Live, we meet comic Chris Rock. That and more on the next Fresh Air.